Hey, this is Julio.
Hey, this is Steve.
Before the podcast starts, we want to welcome and give you the opportunity to support our ministry by visiting our website at www.bridgeminlaredo.org. Scroll down to the bottom of any page and you'll find the PayPal donate button.
Bridge Ministries exists to share the glorious good news of Jesus Christ and to equip people to be transformed by the renewing of their minds. If you would like to help us in our mission of making affordable or free Bibles and Christian books available, and also to check out the orphanage that we support, visit our website.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're back with another episode of Bridge Radio, and I'm excited for this one. This is podcast number 12. I'm your host, as always, Julio Rodriguez. You can call me July, and across from me, I have my homeboy, Shane Kirk. What's up, man?
How's it going, guys?
Are you excited for this podcast?
I am. It's been a while, but I'm excited.
Yeah, it has. I actually watched the film that we're going to be discussing. We actually have a special guest who actually made the film. So, but I watched it again last night with a friend who hadn't seen it at all, and he was like, wow, this is a great documentary. And at some points, he was like sitting up and looking at the TV because his mind was just being blown.
Yeah, me and my wife were taking notes.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. Yeah, no, so with me, anytime it comes with to the realm of creation, apologetics, anything with the sciences, philosophy, biology, astronomy, I just totally geek out. And I love the debate between creation and evolution and the debate, old Earth, new Earth. So, yeah, we're going to dive in that today. There was a documentary or a film that was released this year in February, and the title of this is Genesis History. And today we have on the producer, writer, and director of the film. He's not also a writer, producer, and director of the film, but he's a theologian, naval officer, missionary, and a school director and a marketer. And so welcome to the program, Thomas Purfoy, or Purfoy. Which one is it?
Purefoy.
Purefoy.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. So the first thing that I really wanted to compliment about the film is just it's beautiful. It's the best film I've seen for the defense of creationism and giving a good reason. The cinematography is excellent. I absolutely love the audio, the visuals. Y'all used a lot of the drone, right? In the making of it?
We did.
Oh, man, those drone shots were amazing. They got me.
Well, I tell you, the Lord was gracious. There's many a time that I think we only crashed it once. And there was many a time I was like, okay, I don't think we're walking away with the drone. And we always did.
Oh, wow.
So
that's awesome. And the illustrations, I love the illustrations, the drawing sketches. I just love, I don't know. To me, when I look at film, I look at all those details, and it was awesome.
I thought the arguments were laid out so perfectly to help you walk through mm-hmm. the entire argument step by step.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, thank you. Thank you for producing such an awesome film. And I just wanted to let you know that.
Well, you're kind to say it. It was a labor of love, and the Lord was most gracious to pull all the pieces together. That there are a lot of people involved and doing a lot of work in that, so it represents the labor of lots of folks.
Yeah. So how has the response and feedback been? We were talking before we went live that they want you to hold a year anniversary of the film. So again, like how's the response and feedback been from the film, both from critics and Christians as well?
Well, I mean, from the perspective of that was our distributor who we spoke to, Fathom Events. And they actually, so one of the ladies said that they've gotten calls all the time on this film saying how much folks enjoyed it mm-hmm. and how much they appreciated it. It's a little bit of an odd film, and I'll be the first to say it. I mean, my background mm-hmm. actually is some of film appreciation and film and just the history of documentaries and so forth. And it is, as a documentary, I mean, it's not necessarily even a very, it's not, you know, it's not cinema verite. It's not a following these guys around, mm-hmm. which is, to be honest, I would have actually liked to do more. We just didn't have the time and the ability to do that, digging into stuff. But as a documentary, it's really just a bunch of talking heads explaining things mm-hmm. in front of things. And so from a critical perspective, that's kind of how I look at it and realize it's a little bit of an unusual piece. The response to it, however, is I think that we got, it was a very overwhelming response. I think, I'm not sure if it still is, but it was one of the highest grossing film of the, for a Fathom event of the year.
Wow.
I think it's because there's a lot of interest and personal interest that people have in this.
Right.
And so, for instance, we, it got onto Netflix pretty quickly in early June. And so what we have heard back is we're hearing a lot of binge watching that they actually have to watch. Like, we hear people watch it like 8 or 9 times, which to me is a little bit surprising. But I think it's because we put a lot of content in it. And so it's it's kind of a dense film. And it's a little bit heavy. So you kind of, if you're wanting to get it, we kind of throw a lot of arguments. So we broke a lot of rules in it to do it, to kind of approach it in a way that was a little more intellectually in-depth than your most of your documentaries are. And I think that that just, it, the reward was that people were actually looking for more data, more depth.
Yeah.
And even though the film, to be quite honest, is only a kind of shallow. I mean, we only can spend 100 minutes going into this stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're introducing more stuff actually to complement it. So that was to answer your question. And then from the critical side, I think that folks have been a little frustrated about the way we frame the argument.
Mm-hmm.
And I can speak to that later. There's a very specific reason why we did that. But in general, folks have been very complimentary and said, you know, from an aesthetic perspective, you know, that it's a pretty film. So that was a, again, the Lord's gracious. When you open the camera up, in some cases, his earth is very beautiful.
Yes.
And so the easy part's filming it.
Yeah. Yeah, that drone action. Every time, man, God bless us with the drone, man. Because every time, I mean, just with any shot, when everybody uses, I'm always just like mind blown when people use it. So what was the driving force that wanted you to create this film?
Well, there are a couple things. I mean, one of the things I mentioned a few times in places that I have a then 10-year-old daughter who had just seen the Ken Ham Bill Nye debate and was intrigued and kind of, you know, questioning what had not really been presented, this evolutionary view of the world. Bill Nye, you know, presented it. And she asked some really good questions, one of which was, isn't this a different story, a different history of what happened in the past? And that really got me thinking about the way I like to approach the biblical text as really a narrative, but it's a history of events. And what it made me realize is that what was going on with the evolutionary view of the world, it had often been categorized as an issue of theology or as an issue of science. And I realized that there's a whole discipline, a whole area that sits outside of both of those. It's related, but it's the question of history. This question of history follows different rules and follows different, there's different ways of approaching it. Meaning, when you deal with history, you're asking questions about duration. How long does something last? What are the events? What are the people? I mean, you get this with World War II. Any history you look at is very driven by those three questions. You know, what happens, when, how, what are the effects, what are the results, what are the causes in some cases. So when you start looking at that, that changes the question about origins when you're looking at them as historical questions. And I realized that the question of history and a historical structure was a paradigmatic concept, that it wasn't that it was a scientific view per se, but that it was a historical view that science worked into, as that I felt was much more foundational. So I felt I wanted a film that would explore the question as an issue of history, as opposed simply to an issue of science, you know, this scientific fact versus that scientific fact.
Right.
I did not feel like that. I mean, I felt like that's kind of a dead end.
Okay.
Just to look at it that way.
Right, right. Yeah, so you use the worm word paradigm, and that's commonly used all throughout the film. It starts, and so I do kind of want to give our listeners a little sneak peek into the film. So can you explain to us what a paradigm is, and then also what are the two major competing paradigms that are out right now, and exactly like your daughter said, you know, hey. Bill Nye saying one story, and then you have Ken Ham saying another story. You know, these two can't fit together, and they're completely opposite. Again, just to rephrase the question, you know, what's a paradigm, and what are the two competing paradigms that are out right now?
Yeah, so we define a paradigm really as a framework of views and assumptions mm-hmm. that are used basically to interpret data. Mm-hmm. The idea comes originally out of, you know, Thomas Kuhn's work. He was a 20th century philosopher of science. But in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, he actually was criticized of using paradigm, you know, in too many different ways.
Okay.
And he comes back in another essay and says, you know, paradigm is really interesting. It can be used, and he says it can be used as a way of how an entire discipline, mm-hmm. so a whole discipline of science, looks at a certain set of data. So, for instance, let's look at, for instance, the question of does the sun circle around the earth or the earth circle around the sun?
Mm-hmm.
This is a paradigmatic view that's going to re-influence all of your data, how you interpret the data that you have. Now, so that paradigm is a framework, though, that is used to basically explain how you look at things. So that's a view of the paradigm. The paradigm I was presenting, though, was a historic paradigm. So there are lots of different types of paradigms. And so I was suggesting that there is an assumption about the age of the Earth that therefore influences how you interpret the data. And so the general view that folks would have from the, and what we presented one is the conventional paradigm, which is the general view that the Earth is billions of years old. And the universe is even more, you know, up to 13 billion years old, and versus a paradigm that takes its chronology from the Bible. The chronology from the conventional paradigm would generally be used on radioisotope dating. The two ways they get that real paradigm, radioisotope dating and then redshifts. So interpreting the redshift distances as being, you know, this is how long the light has been traveling, ergo we know this is how old the universe is, and, you know, we take these meteorites. You know, Claire Patterson did it in 53. The meteorite says it was supposedly occurred when the cooling event happened in our galaxy. So that's 4. You know, 5, 6, whatever billion years old for the age of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And those chronology items are pretty much a fix from those things today. Now, there's the idea of old age goes way back. I mean, that goes back to the, you know, turn of the century from 1700s to 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't. They had a different view of it. So that's a paradigm that I would argue then. All of the data, so for about almost 200 plus years, has been worked into this view that rejects the chronology that's provided in scripture, which does seem in for, you know, 1800 years or longer, they were like, well, it's a universe that's less than 10,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So all the events then have to fit into it. And so
right.
the 6 day. Yeah. And so that hence. That's really the two comparison points with the paradigms of history, which is why old Earth creationists and theistic evolutionists were unhappy with the film, because they really fall into a historical paradigm that is the conventional paradigm of 13.8 billion years. And that's what they fit. They accepted it as being an accurate view of time passing. So that's how we divided the whole film, was on those two paradigms.
Right.
Two ways of looking at history.
Okay. All right. And I really loved that the film was presented in a question. The title of the film is Genesis History. So this question is more directed for Christians, but why is it important that we as Christians have an answer for is Genesis history? And what are the implications? Because I feel like if we don't see it as history, as Jesus did commonly in Matthew 19:4-5, even Paul in Romans 5 references to a real Adam, to a real Eve, and to a real Garden of Eden and creation. So if we go ahead and undermine that, what are the implications of that?
Well, I mean, you've said it. I mean, I think Martin Lloyd Jones said it best. He said, unless Genesis is history, I have no gospel. So I think that what you have to realize is that the Bible presents a continuum of events that are under God's control, which basically are the pattern of events that lead from creation, fall, and redemption. And so the order and event, the duration of events, the specificity of events, all these things are things that are assumed in the New Testament as being the reason for why they're there. So
yeah.
Jesus does, I mean, very much, you look at Luke 3, it takes Jesus' baptism, where God says he's the Son of God. It then traces his genealogy all the way back to Adam, who, guess what, Luke says, points out he was also the Son of God.
Yeah.
And then where does it go? It goes to Luke 4, and you've got the temptation, which is back to what's a repeat of what's going to go in the garden. And so is why Milton had Paradise Lost. His first book was looking at the fall. His second book, Paradise Regained, was looking at the temptation. And so these are just a one of many, many, many historical patterns that are where the event that recurs in Genesis, whether it's creation in 6 days, whether it is the instantaneous creation of men and all the animals by in their terms of their kind, it's the creation of Adam, Eve from Adam, a real fall. All these real space-time events are consequential to the nature of the gospel, and in fact, the gospel relies on their historicity. So that was why that question is really,
it's
is
important.
Genesis history, I would say, is at the center of, is the gospel true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because if there's no fall, then Jesus didn't die for, he died for nothing, you know? Like, if there was no actual fall.
If there's no fall, that's correct. If there was no space-time fall that essentially created original sin, of which we are now all guilty. I mean, so I was at a, just the other week, it's very interesting. I was at the Wheaton, and I shown the film, and they actually, a few 2 weeks later, some professors who did not agree with the film came up and had a talk, and they opened up the students to ask questions. One of the questions, they were theistic evolutionists as professors, the majority of them. One of the kids said, well, what does theistic evolution do for original sin? Well, I mean, that's a, who knows? There was no good answer was given because there is no good answer. One of the other kids, well, what does it mean for the historical Adam? And again, there is no good answer.
Yeah.
So the problem is that when you look at the New Testament, Peter, Paul, Jesus, Jude, they all are referring to these people as real people who did things that have consequences today.
Yeah.
And so it'd be like asking an American, well, how important is it really that George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson were historical people?
Right.
Like, couldn't they just have been made up?
Right.
And you're kind of like, well, gosh, I think they did things that are still,
we're
still bearing the consequences today. Like, the Declaration of Independence is a real document, and they really did revolt from England, and he really did, you know, cross the Delaware. These things really had to have happened.
Yeah.
So that's how I feel like Genesis is that consequential.
Yes.
And that everyone kind of gets it as consequential. So the film is just simply asking that question, and then looks at the areas that then say it's not possible, which are these various areas of scientific interpretation, which are saying, well, if this interpretation is true, well, that historical event couldn't be true. I mean, it's to quote Huxley, and I'll end there. Thomas Huxley said, look, all the ecclesiastical books of Revelation say one thing, and then nature says another. They can't both be true. So, and he's exactly right. This is the 19th century. He's right. If you're interpreting nature in a certain way and you're interpreting the books in a certain way, then if they're mutually contradictory, well, then you can't, they can't both be exactly true in those interpretations. So either you change your interpretation in Genesis or you change your interpretation of nature. It's one or the other.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thought that I've always told through a Bible study that I lead for a youth group, I always tell them, like, you know, you want your theology to be as close to the bullseye as possible. Obviously, we're not going to get everything accurate. We can't know everything about God. But when Jesus, you know, refers to an Adam, a fall, and we just don't believe in that, we're undermining his word. And I mean, Jesus was the Son of God, and so we should be following that. I mean, it's really simple. And Shane, you had a question?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was absolutely insightful the way that the idea of the flood harmonized so well with the evidence. I've actually never heard the argument put forth before. I think most scientists agree that there was a catastrophic event that completely wiped out the dinosaurs and the way that it laid the fossil record. And could you just kind of walk us through just the basics of how the flood damaged the earth in such a catastrophic way that altered the terrain as well as how it affected the dinosaurs?
Yeah, hold on one second. Yeah, because I thought the film brought up a good point, because just growing up in Sunday school, it's like the ark, you know, two draft heads sticking up and just a bunch of rain falling down,
right?
Yeah,
that's what I thought. It was just elephants walking onto the ark as the rainfall gently rises up, not some catastrophic event
mountains. This was a very violent thing that happened, or an event that happened.
Yes, and so it's interesting, that comment about Sunday school is fascinating. Mm-hmm. What used to happen in the 19th century is they had rejected this idea that the... So the question, take a step back. The question is, so where did all the rock layers come from?
Mm-hmm.
You got all these sedimentary rock layers around the world, and they have fossils on them, so where did they come from? So when the geologists back in the early 19th century rejected that the flood had laid these strata, these rock layers down, well, what they began to say is, well, so where's there the flood? Well, maybe that's the highest layer. Well, it had to have been a calm flood. So that actually was beginning to be taught by ministers that, oh, well, maybe the flood was a very calm flood and it was very small and they began to move it to the Middle East. What ends up happening is that this whole view of geology, of a slow and gradual processes, that view actually in the 20th century even began to be questioned, that people began to say, well, gosh, there seemed like there are a lot of catastrophes in the past, and they actually begin to go back to a view that had been held more by the late 18th, early 19th century. So the fact is that even in conventional geology, these things have actually kind of shifted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that comes into this question of that. So what it was the flood? Well, the idea that most of guys like a guy like Steve Austin would have mm-hmm. is that this was a catastrophic event through something that they would call catastrophic plate tectonics, where basically the ocean bottoms erupted in some form of a magma event, pushing waters up onto the continent through the use of tectonics, this movement of Earth that then began to wipe across the continent, but not necessarily in a way like, okay, all the water's up there.
Mm-hmm.
What they're often talking about are lots of motions where water may cover something and wipe it out and literally scrape everything off the surface.
Mm-hmm.
And it could potentially be bare for a period of time, then drop back down and have more water come on top of it.
Mm.
The picture that they're presenting is one where there are massive water events that then create mud flows that begin to rush across the surface of the parts of the Earth. And this is basically the way that you have these various layers picked up and put into a sequence of strata
mm-hmm.
that starts with very much low ocean creatures, as you see in the Cambrian.
Yeah.
And as it moves up into more amphibious-type creatures and then moves into fish. And then all of a sudden you've got your dinosaurs and small mammals and other interesting creatures. But they fall in certain orders, and there's always consistently marine-type shells, invertebrate, throughout the whole fossil record.
Mm-hmm.
So someone, you've got to put all those pieces together, and that's how they would argue, is that that seems to be the most reasonable explanation. And let's be honest, there's a lot of things these guys don't know, a lot of mm-hmm. questions that both sides have trying to explain the order of fossils, the nature of the strata, the size of the strata. I mean, you start digging into the data, and you're like, huh, this is strange mm-hmm. for everyone. Like, that's just weird.
Yes.
But big patterns, that's how I would argue that, and that's how they would argue, it seems to make the most sense, is these large packages of rock, many of which that go across entire continents, they make the most sense to be laid down in a massive catastrophic flooding event, with waters moving back and forth and across the Earth's surface. And underneath the Earth, the tectonics of mountain building and actually huge sections of the continent moving up and then back down because of all that's going on under the Earth's surface and the crust.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long explanation, but it's a very complex event that they're now trying to explain through these use of catastrophic plate tectonics.
Yeah. And as the fossil record becomes more complete and we find out more about all the dinosaurs, what would you say about people who still want to say that evolution takes place through, you know, it goes from basically hydrogen to human, but we're finding all these missing pieces in the fossil record?
Well, I mean, I think that the biggest problem that atheistic evolutionist has, and they often realize it, is just a question of the beginning of life and the introduction of complex information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the intelligent design guys, this is what they really hammer on, is like, look, if you're talking about just simple physics coming up with life, it's impossible. Like, it's not even like even a possibility, like it's literally impossible. The question really then becomes, well, so what do you do with all of the living, complex creatures that are there. So evolutionists, or many of them, they're very smart people, and they've had a lot of time to come up with views that are, you know, in some cases, well, I can see kind of how that's not unreasonable. But some of the areas it becomes very difficult to explain, even from an evolutionary perspective. And I mean, a perfect example is the Cambrian explosion, where you have this enormous amount of diversity, and it's a high, called a high disparity, and a low diversity, I think, is the right way you describe it, where you've got an enormous number of body plans that just appear. But the problem is that this a sudden appearance of body plans you see throughout the fossil record, which, you know, led guys like Stephen Gould to talk about punctuated equilibrium, that, you know, just every equilibrium of species is punctuated by sudden evolutionary changes. But it's not just there. I mean, you see it with the emergence of dinosaurs. There's some up here. You see it with the emergence of mammals. Again, no, we don't even talk about this in the film, the mammalian radiation, as it's called officially, that happens in the early Cenozoic. They all disappear, like literally elephants and bats and all these creatures that we're like, okay, that's really weird and different. They're just all there. So I think that you got to start to look at these big strokes on data and say, oh, how do you explain this? And from an evolutionary perspective, it's just really hard because you're dealing with genetic information. And everyone, we know how complex it is. So the idea that this is a design that was intended to diversify very quickly, that we've interpreted as evolution, if you use your paradigm of lots of time. So if you go back to that paradigm of history, and there's a lot of time, well, then you've got to come up with something like evolution, because you got to explain why it's changing. Otherwise, you're like, well, okay, well, actually, maybe this is all intended from the beginning, and there isn't a lot of time. So the time influences the way you look at the data.
Interesting. And I was going to say, I wanted to ask as well, there are a lot of scientists who are now starting to drop the neo-Darwinian view of evolution, correct?
So, yes, it's an interesting question. I mean, there are some, there's a motion to what's called the extended evolutionary synthesis. It's a group that so neo-Darwinian synthesis came about in the 30s when they realized that pure Darwinism had not really taken genetics into example and population genetics. So that was where neo-Darwinism came in. Well, you have the introduction of a number of areas, the complexity of the genome and the world of epigenetics, which is shows that there is basically the genome actually can kind of reprogram itself and turn things on and off. And then it was this last summer in Scotland, I believe, they had a big conference. And so you have some evolutionists who are like, we do not need a new synthesis. We just need to kind of tweak what we currently are thinking. Other guys are like, nope, we got to throw a lot of this out and we've got to really rebuild a mechanism. And that's what most people don't realize, is that it's not, evolutionary thinking may present a unified front, but when you start digging into it, there is no consistent view of mechanism for all of evolution. What everyone agrees with, well, it's old and it's billions of years, so we agree with the geologists and their interpretation of age, but how things work, there is no consensus. And so we just say, well, it just evolved. Well, how? And what? And what do you get? So when you start, the devil's in the details and everything. And as you dig in, there are a lot of evolutionists right now that begin to start questioning that this simple natural selection, mutations with the, you know, populations changing slowly over time doesn't really seem to fit the data.
I mean, even the geologists, I think in the film you said, they use different dating methods that give them different results.
That was interesting.
So it's interesting, And so what happens, the world of radioisotope dating is very complex, and you're making a number of assumptions about it. And so let's be honest, guys that follow this and think that this is, you know, absolutely true, again, very smart people, they are very convinced that any anomalies can be explained within their system. But an enormous amount, you have to realize that an enormous amount of weight is put on radioisotope dating in all these areas. I mean, Colin Renfrew, and just in the area of like human prehistory, all this, you know, carbon 14, he says at the front of his book, Prehistory, we rely on radiocarbon dating really to kind of give us an order of things. Radioisotope dating is huge. And if it is in, it has made mistakes or is off in any way, then it throws everything out. And so when you start comparing other areas, you know, is it soft tissue? Is it salt in the oceans? Is it the sedimentary record itself? Is it the lack of bioturbation? Is it the you can go on and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. There are many, many things that would call these radioisotope dates as absolute dates in the question. And I think that they're very reasonable to say, I'm not sure this is all accurate. Mm-hmm. Because they basically, I mean, as my friend Kurt Wise was talking to Steve Gould himself, and he said, Steve, doesn't it bother you that all of your science, he's a paleontologist, is based on what the physicists are saying? Steve was like, no, because they're right. I know they're not wrong. And you're like, well, how do you know they're not wrong? Because you're basically basing everything on physicists and geologists saying that we know that this rock was laid down, you know, 540 million years ago. We are absolutely sure of that. Well, they can't be. I mean, I appreciate this is not questioning their intelligence. They're brilliant men thinking this.
Yes.
I would just argue that they're following a paradigm and they're necessarily fitting the data into that paradigm.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So speaking on dating, the one thing that blew my mind was Dr. Kevin Anderson, the microbiologist expert, his organic tissue, that finding.
The Triceratops.
Dude, that there in the film, I was like, even my friend was sitting back and he was like, really? Yeah,
talk about an anomaly.
Anomaly. So talk about that, Thomas. That was excellent.
So that's an interesting story because it's funny. The creationists were not the ones that found this. I mean, Mary Schweitzer was one of the first to really do this work. And if you go back, it's actually in the literature in various places, but no one recognized what it was. So Mark Armitage had done a lot of this work and has a really good lecture online discussing this, showing the history of it, that like it was again, and Schweitzer says this in one of her interviews. She said, it's kind of funny that I figured this out because I think everyone was following a paradigm. She used to use this idea that it's old, therefore it can't be any tissue in it. Yeah. So that whole story is fascinating there because actually, well, I don't know if it didn't even come out in the film. When Mark and Kevin found that Triceratops horn, Mark actually did the microscopy work on it. And he said when he opened up the horn, sections of it needed to be decalcified. Mm-hmm. But that tissue we showed in the film was actually a fibrillar, I can't get the right word for it. It was actually soft, that section. He pulled it out as it was and you saw it. There was no decalcification. And he documents this in his article on Acta Histica. At a very technical level, but that's crazy. Like, I didn't even decalcify this. And I think that it's just the need, as Kevin points out, all of that finding, and it's now been found very common, has just been all said, well, we know these things are 65, 75 million years old, so this stuff must last this long. And so it shows, it strains the credulity that you can actually think this, and when you're like, I mean, look, this is the reason why coroners know how long a body's been dead.
Yeah.
What's the decomposition of it? So right now, we're using dating regularly on bodies and saying, well, we know how long tissue lasts, and we think this is, yes, in some unusual circumstances, it might last thousands of years, like with mummification, but really millions?
Yeah. 70 million? Wow.
It breaks everything that we possibly know, and yet you will see, if you follow that paradigm of history, you cannot allow those data are interpreted that way. So old Earth creationists, evolutionary creationists, they must reinterpret it and try to find some explanation for, which is the iron model, which is all, I would argue, has all kinds of problems based on radiation just in the soil. Mm-hmm. But anyway, not to get into any of this, I mean, as you can see, every one of these areas is a little bit like a rabbit hole. I mean, you can fall off it.
Oh, yeah. With this movie, I feel like it's a very well introduction. And from there, and I know you're working on it and you're working hard to produce more films and material, but I just encourage everyone who's listening to go shoot, man. go get into it.
So we actually have already begun to release this stuff. We have released our first set of Beyond is Genesis History, and that is 20 short films that are 20 minutes each, about 6 hours and 40 minutes of material.
Nice.
Just on rocks and fossils. Ooh. And so we provided that one, and then we'll provide Life and Design will come out in a few more months, and then we'll do Stars in the Bible. So those are actually now available on our website, and I think they'll be on Amazon digital video soon. And so it enables folks just to dig deeper into all these areas because, I mean, let's be honest, it's a lot of material.
It's intensive,
quickly, but we still don't go very deep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, of course.
So that almost begs the question, how much evidence do you think, or what evidence do you think would take to get scientists, the majority of scientists, to switch from the conventional paradigm to the Genesis paradigm?
There's no evidence that'll do it.
Yeah. I would think that the
Triceratops having,
Yeah.
it's been out. It was done in 2005. And if you read the literature, folks said this can't be. So early initial responses to it were that this is not old because we know how old it is. This has to be bacteria. It has to be a contamination.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they realized it wasn't, then you had to go work through ideas. So that's a very interesting, shall we call it a sociological study of the responses of scientists to a piece of evidence that would seem to everybody, well, this obviously has got to be, you know, that old. Well, this is the whole point that I think is so vital to make, that one is wedded to a paradigm and one will reinterpret everything, including the resurrection of Jesus.
Yeah.
So let's think about this. If the priests paid off soldiers who saw the angels, you would think, okay, well, surely they're going to believe because of that. They don't. I mean, Jesus says this. He says, look, you can have someone, the guy, you know, what Lazarus tells him, you know, the rich man in Lazarus, the rich man tells him, look, just go and, you know, he tells Abraham, please just go and tell my family that, you know, this is what they have awaiting for them. And he says, look, they're not going to even believe it if someone was raised from the dead, meaning it's not a matter of enough evidence. Evidence is always interpreted within a framework.
Yeah.
And although pieces, if you have a looser framework, you may be able to look at the evidence and say, as a whole, and that's what we try to do with this film, is it's not about proving creation. It's about saying it's reasonable that the Bible teaches all these points, a historical structure, and it's reasonable to look at the data within that structure and it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Theoretically, you could have tons of ideas that don't make sense in terms of data. So this is not an anti-realist film.
Yeah.
It's simply saying that the data as a whole and as individual parts actually fits really well within this biblical paradigm of how you look at history. But it's not trying to prove anything. It's not, because I don't believe that's possible to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, and you see it in the history of science.
Yeah.
Regular, brilliant men look at pieces of data we would look at now and say, how did they see that? How did they think it that way?
Right.
Just because it wasn't a question of their intelligence.
Yeah.
That was just the paradigm they developed.
Paradigm. Yeah. And that's one thing that I also, too, want to comment on this documentary, the experts that you got as well. Just because growing up, I remember in high school, I mean, in science class, when they were teaching evolution, I would always object and ask questions. And I remember I was always, my intellectual abilities were always questioned. I was always made fun of, and they're like, oh, well, you're listening to these like dumb creationists that believe all this nonsense and Bible stuff. But whenever you actually, you know, hear them out, you're like, wow, these are smart individuals. So you're correct in that, man.
What we really tried to do that is I wanted people to see that there were very smart men, and in some cases women. We didn't interview them in this film, but there are a lot of scientists that are women that do this. There are smart men and women who accept this and are not checking their brain at the door, and that, you know, are very willing to recognize there's a lot they don't understand.
Yeah.
But that's what every scientist, any scientist you talk to that's worth his salt is going to say, oh yeah, there's a ton I don't understand in my field, much less all these other fields that I really don't know anything about. I mean, most people don't realize that most PhDs are like alligators in the water, man. They are in their area of expertise.
Yeah.
They are dominant, but you get them out of that. Yeah. They're going to struggle a little bit in land, and you start moving them into areas that they're way unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
And they may be smart people, but they may not know any more than you do.
Mm. Yeah.
And so, that's an important thing to say, is that there are a lot of smart people that say this is very reasonable, and that is a push. I feel like on the film, if there's anything, I wanted to really put that to rest, that this is not dumb people accepting
yes.
this view.
Yes, exactly. All right, Thomas, last question. This is from somebody from our ministry, Michelle Basler, and she has a question. Where do you get the idea of cavemen, and where do they fall in the Bible's timeline of history?
Oh, interesting question.
Yeah.
So the idea of cavemen really started when you had the discovery of Neanderthals that were then attached in the 19th century. That piece of data, these Neanderthals, some of the different Homo skeletons that were being found, the hominid skeletons and hominins, they began to take the timeline of old ages and say, well, these must be precursors to man. They must be, and they began to interpret and put a story to them. So the idea of cavemen and so forth, those
right.
are what the assumptions there. However, if you look back historically, people have lived in caves. In fact, people probably are still living in caves, have lived in caves throughout time because they're really a safe place to live. And in the biblical structure, people would say, well, actually, folks like Neanderthals were probably living in Europe during the Ice Age, and therefore they lived in caves, but they didn't just live in caves. They lived in other structures, and so the Neanderthals are a great picture. These are a people that were fully human.
Mm-hmm.
They created beautiful jewelry. They were buried their dead. They had huge, now you go look at some of the jewelry they're made, you're like, whoa, this would be amazing today. So the idea of the caveman is a myth that was basically used to present that there were some pre-primitive humans that were not fully human.
Right.
And so we made movies like, Conan the Barbarian and things like that, presented these cavemen. And so it kind of went into our consciousness. But when you go back and look at even the cave that's been found in Georgia that has six separate human skulls in it, and they're all different types, like Homo erectus and Homo Neanderthalus, and they're all in the same cave.
Hmm.
Well, that's weird. So they're buried in the same cave. They clearly were living at the same time, near the same time of each other.
Yeah.
Maybe these are just all different types of humans that, we got a lot of different types of dogs. We got a lot of different types of humans.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Good question, Michelle. All right. Well, that wraps up this interview. Thomas, man, it was such a blessing to have you on. We hope to have you back sometime soon. That invite's always open, and we could set it up.
Well, my pleasure. I hope I can give you long-winded at times going into it. This material is so interesting, and there's just so much. And I would encourage Christians,
yes.
really, this is not, I would even say, about apologetics. It's about the joy of learning about what God has done
Amen.
In the history, in our past, and seeing how all the Bible, Del Tackett likes to say it, lots of people will say, the Bible doesn't get its history right, but as archaeologists and everyone else continue to show, it does get its history right. And so I think this is just another area that over time people are like, it is kind of funny. I think the Bible gets its history right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, I think, as Christians can study this and really dig into it, at the end of the day, they're like, I think it's just it's a reasonable book of history.
Yeah.
Amen. Yeah.
Absence of evidence is an evidence of absence. I always like that line. All right. Well, that wraps up our podcast today. And we'll be back next week for the next one. Love the Lord God, your God, with all your heart, strength, and soul. And love your neighbor as you love yourself. And we will see you on the next one. Thank you, Thomas, for coming on.
Sounds great. Thanks a lot. Take care.